This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
And this lady comes up to me and says, "Do you have medicine?" And so, of course, as a traveler going to a tropical place, of course, I had medicine. And so I say, "Yes." And said, "Okay, our shaman is sick. Could you come and check, you know, what he has?" And I'm thinking, okay, I don't have any kind of medical training whatsoever.
That was Laura Lou Desjardins, who is today's guest. She was talking about the time she was in a remote village and she was asked to be the village doctor. You're not going to believe how this story ends. You're going to hear it today. Laura Lou is full of incredible stories. She's a French lawyer who has lived in 7 different countries, speaks 4 languages, and has been working on environmental issues and fighting injustices on behalf of indigenous people around the world for over a decade. Today, you're going to hear her tips on ethical travel in indigenous areas, some advice for cracking the cultural code wherever you travel so you can get more out of your trip, the importance of being unafraid when following some different paths in life that others may not necessarily agree with. And of course, we commiserate on the curiosities of life in Norway as immigrants, where we both live. All of that and much more happening in today's show right now. So buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here and welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show, my friend. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. Excited to bring you this conversation today. Always a treat when I get to talk in person with somebody, and this interview took place in my backyard. Laura Lou, as I mentioned, is a fellow immigrant to Norway. She has a very popular blog called A Frog in the Fjord, and she actually wrote a book of the same name. It's been a bestseller here in Norway. Of course, we talk about the book and some quirky things we've experienced as foreigners here in Norway. And I'd say one of the core themes here is just integrating in another culture. And as she put it, cracking the cultural code, which is always on every traveler's agenda, right? When we can crack that cultural code even a little bit, we're able to meet more locals, enhance our trip, have more authentic experiences. So that's a big part of this conversation, as well as all of the other things you heard. I'm going to get into it in just a moment. First, a quick reminder to stick around on the back end if you'd like. I want to give a shout out to somebody in this community who reminded me of a phrase I like to say that really fires me up and keeps me going on an exciting path, so I'll share that with you, as well as a quote that offers a reminder of the power we hold within. Thanks for listening. Please enjoy my chat with Laura Lou, and I'll see you on the other side, my friend. Laura Lou Desjardins, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for being here. I just wanted to try out my French. That's the most French thing I've ever said, by the way. I know zero French, but it seems like a beautiful language. You were kind enough to come up here, and now we're sitting in my backyard. Sun's out. We can't always say that in Norway.
True.
Right? I'm really excited to chat with you. The last time we met, we were not recording, but you gave me your book, A Frog in the Fjord, 1 year in Norway, which was actually 5 years in Norway, condensed down into one, but 5 years of experience. So we'll talk about that. But I loved it. I read the whole thing. I can definitely recommend it. So I want to let everybody know to check that out. And what an accomplishment.
Thanks.
Writing a book in not your native language.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit of a challenge, but I did learn English as a child in Australia when I was living there. So I had it in me, but it's true that writing a book when it's not your native language is a bit more challenging. But the idea is also to write this for all travelers coming to Norway, whether you want to move here or just travel here, and also those who don't have English as a native language. So I hope that it resonated with everyone.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I mean, I'm going to ask you some questions later on just about as travelers, long-term, short-term travelers. I mean, you want to figure out different ways you can integrate into culture. And, you know, that was one of the threads, I think, in the book is like you trying to find your way into Norway and kind of like find your way into the culture and find your place there. But you've been doing this on a broader scope for many, many years. And that's where I want to start is your work in human rights with indigenous people. And I mean, you just sent me a couple stories in email before this and I was just like, wow. So I know we're gonna hear some good ones today. Well, I mean, just, I guess, explain to people and explain a bit to me what you've been doing for years and how you ended up following this career path.
So I was born in Paris and from a French mom and actually a Canadian father from Quebec. And my parents had me and my brother quite young.
How old were they?
They were 23.
And where did they meet?
They met in Canada.
Okay.
And they're a bit like originals. You know, my mom is a carpenter and mm-hmm. my father is a nurse. What happened is that they wanted to travel. And they had two small children, 3 and 1. So I was the one who was 3 years old. And they decided at that point to cross the Australian desert for a year in a break. So in a
really?
In a car. Yeah. So I did that.
Cross the desert with a 3 and a 1-year-old?
Yeah. So I did.
As an adventure?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't have nappies anymore, but my brother did. And getting there, they stopped several months in Asia and then they went to Australia. So we did that for, I think, 9 or 10 months.
Do you remember it?
I mean, it's very strange. Not really, because I've seen pictures. I'm not sure whether what I remember comes from the pictures or reality, but I do remember feelings. And I remember I had a lot of nightmares that I was going to be eaten by a lion. Although there are no lions in the Australian desert, but I didn't know that as a 3-year-old.
Were you all walking?
No, we were in the car.
Okay.
But, you know, this is before seatbelts and security and all that stuff.
Right.
So we were in the back in this brake. I don't know if it's called a brake. It's like this car with the back is totally flat. So we were just playing in the background and
just
stopping.
Hanging out playing, driving through the desert.
Exactly. So we did that and my parents kind of had this travel bug, right? So they were moving around all the time. And their kind of model was that they would go back to France when they needed money. Then they would work a lot, save up money, and they didn't really own that much. And then they would go back to somewhere. So we spent many years in Australia. We went back and forth. And also in Asia, a lot in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand. Yeah, so those were mainly the places. But so what happened is that because I was a child living this life, it kind of changes a little bit your perspective on things. And I think it brought to me, you know, I'm very adaptable. Mm. So my friends and my family say, you know, you can put me in any place on earth where there are two people and I will learn the language. I will I will find a job. I will adapt.
Yeah.
But also, I remember as a child, what I wanted was stability, right? I wanted a television. I wanted childhood friends. Yeah. So, I mean, that's another side of things.
You were kind of longing for that you didn't have.
Yeah, I was longing for that. We were moving a lot. But
what were the ages? Can I just ask so I can get some context?
Yeah, so it's between 3 years old and 11 years old.
Okay, very formative years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But during those years, I was, the last years were quite important. Like when I was between 9 and 11, then we lived in a village in Australia, which had a very high proportion of indigenous peoples. And I think I looked back on it afterwards and realized maybe that was, you know, those years were so important for me maybe. And that year I didn't have that many friends. So I was reading a lot of books. And I think I was observing as well. And so I don't know what happened. But after that, when I was 18, I decided to learn Indonesian and Malay at university. And I took a degree in Southeast Asian studies.
Well, what were the things that you witnessed during that time that impacted you in your life?
I think it was very strange because I was, you know, I'm French, I'm white, and I get to this place where I'm an immigrant. I spoke English, but not that well because I had learned it and unlearned it several times in my childhood because we were going back and forth. But I came to this village and I remember being accepted by, you know, the kind of Caucasian Australians there more than they were accepting the Aboriginals whom they had grown up with. So I think that, and there was a lot of violence as well at school, I remember, and I could hear the adults around me talking about, you know, Aboriginals not allowed to go into this bar. And so I think it's like this background noise that you can't be part of, but that you understand that there's this injustice. And then I went back several years later as a teenager and to the same village. And then I realized that, you know, the indigenous people, I mean, the indigenous friends I had had quite rough stories between that age of 10 and 15. Most of them had dropped out of school. It was really heavy. And I think it just stuck with me that this is not right. You know, there's something there that's just not right. Australia is very close to Indonesia. And I spent a lot of time in Indonesia as a child. And in Australia at school, we were learning Indonesian. So then, you know, from 11 to 18, I was in France going to school. And then I decided I want to learn the Southeast Asian language. I want to travel. And what better than Indonesian, a language spoken by, I think, over 300 million people, 350 million people. So I just took a chance. I studied that for 3 years, literature, history, everything. Yeah, and then I realized it would be hard to find a job, so I studied law. And then eventually I managed to merge the two. You know, and then I went to human rights law and environmental law, and then I managed to eventually in my adult life to work with indigenous people's rights and also what happens when, you know, multinational corporations come and take lands or need the resources they need every day to live, whether it's water or, yeah, trees or anything else like that. So okay. I've been working, I think, 17 years in like rainforest protection, human rights law, plastic pollution, etc.
Wow. Okay. You circled back to the travel lifestyle. You wanted the stability as a child, but then...
Exactly.
What happened? Did you have some kind of realization, or was it just that this is where you feel comfortable?
I felt at
the time, at least. I mean, you're settled now, but still in another country, not
exactly,
in your area.
Exactly, still in another country. My husband isn't French. He isn't Norwegian. You know, there's still that kind of element of travel. Yeah, it's you're right. It's a bit strange that I wanted that stability. But then the first thing I did when I turned 18 was put everything in place for me to be able to travel. And I did, because I lived several years in Indonesia. Then I lived in Canada for several years. I lived in the UK. I lived in Denmark. So as an adult, I actually moved around a lot. But I think there's this thing where, you know, there's probably studies about this, but if you travel a lot as a child, there's this kind of need to also travel later in life that is the stability.
The subconscious safe place, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, and you're always the foreigner. I think there's a certain, strangely enough, there's a comfort in always being the one learning new things and a little bit outsider, but trying to integrate, you know. So I've been continuing to do that many, many times.
Why do you thrive in that environment?
I think it's very exciting. I mean, you have a travel podcast, so I'm sure you feel the same. It's very exciting to discover new food, and you discover all these interesting people that, you know, I think we've all had we've all had this experience probably where you leave for a year. You've had the most amazing experiences. You've met so many people. You've seen volcanoes. You've been, you know, scuba diving with dolphins or whatever. And you go back to your parents' home or your uncle's home or whatever, and nothing has changed in their home. Nothing has changed in their lives. And you're thinking, how can we have had, we've had the same year. The same amount of time has passed, yet I have experienced this much.
So I remember that very bizarre feeling of walking in after months and months or away And then just kind of walking in and being like, was that just a dream? Like, did that all just happen?
Exactly. Yeah, and you surpass yourself. You do things that you didn't know you were able to do. And you have so many stories to tell. You know, as you see in my book, I love telling stories. So traveling is also a way to have a lot of inspiration to tell those stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've been able to, like you said, combine your expertise after law and the Indonesian studies and everything that you mentioned before, and combine it in a way where you were able to actually make an impact on indigenous communities, it sounds like, and rainforest protection and stuff like that. I guess this is a twofold thing. One, I just want to hear more about some of the things that you've done, and because I think that's always interesting to hear, because the idea of, well, we're going to protect, you know, these indigenous lands or whatever the idea is. How does that happen? Like, what does that look like in reality? How do people actually do that? How does progress get made? You have some, you know, real world examples. So I think it would be great to hear them. Just, I guess the broader question would be, for somebody listening that's kind of like, well, this is cool that you're able to make a difference in these ways. Like, what advice do you have for somebody that, it doesn't have to necessarily be, I want to work in human rights or whatever, but let's say they want to make a difference in X, Y, or Z thing that matters to them. What would you say?
This is very stereotypical answer, a bit cliche, but I think you have to be unafraid. It's not like my parents were delighted when I told them I was going to study Indonesian and Malay at 18, you know?
You would think they would be, though, because they dragged you guys all over the world. It sounds like that would have been, like, they should give you a hard time about anything.
But they changed in the meantime, and they settled, and it became different. And I think that I didn't have a clear vision of what I wanted. I just went for what I felt was right, and I thought, I want to do this right now. And I didn't have a lot of money. I had to work a lot. It's not like anyone was financing all of that. But I think you just have to be unafraid and kind of, you know, listen to your guts. Is this what you want to do? Like, don't listen to people. I remember when I went to live in Indonesia. So I had a bachelor in Indonesian studies, and I had another one in law. And I had a professor, thankfully, who said to me, look, you know this amazing language, you haven't practiced for a long time, I'm going to help you find an internship there so that you can figure it out, like what you want in life. But I think you should really pursue this. This is really important. So I went there with this internship, which was almost not paid. And kind of, let's see how this goes, you know. And I was going to work for this indigenous organization in Indonesia. And I remember this friend of mine who told me, but you're going to lose all these pension points, these like retirement points.
From France?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And it's like,
because you're working out of the country?
Yeah, because okay. I was not even really working.
Right, not building
it didn't
your
really
career.
Count. I wasn't
right,
building my career.
Sort of the practical.
Exactly. And then I was going to, you know, look into indigenous women's rights. And then I had other people in my family who were like, but you can't make a career out of working with indigenous people's rights and women. And it's like, what do you know? You know, if I want to do this now, it doesn't mean I'm going to be doing this in 30 years. But I think you just have to follow your path in a way. And now, in my position now, nobody tells me, oh, you made all the wrong choices. Because they just look at where you are today, you know? And when I started writing my blog, it's the same. But why are you writing a blog? And you know, why are you writing a book? And most people don't finish it. Well, maybe, but you know, maybe I'll finish mine and maybe.
Yeah, give me a high five. I love that.
So,
Why are there so many naysayers?
I think in France, particularly, there's a lot, because there's this idea that there are only a few paths which are there for you, which is very restrictive. But I think in other countries, maybe the US is a bit different. Maybe Norway as well. But life is long. As I say in the book, my grandmother always says this, you know, life is long. And it's short, but it is also long. And you have time to do a lot of things. And I think that if you make a mistake, if I had made a huge mistake by working with indigenous peoples in Indonesia and lived in the jungle and thought after 6 months, you know, I don't like this, well, I can just turn it around and do something else.
And you still would have had some wonderful experiences.
Exactly. Right? And then you don't regret anything, because I think that's the problem I see in people my age now, people regretting, you know, not doing this or that, or not becoming a dancer or whatever their passion was. So, so I don't have any regrets.
What a wonderful place to be in life, right?
That's true.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Now, back to the show. Working with Indigenous people and human rights, we're going to get into some of the advice around what we as individuals can do, but I wanted to hear about some of your experience. This is like this idea you became the village doctor at some point in one of these villages. I mean, you've lived some pretty incredible experiences that the average traveler doesn't get to experience because there's not that close relationship. And yeah, I mean, you can explain to us, share some stories, share some of the moments that kind of stand out and the connections and some of the stories around that, if you don't mind.
I think, you know, the first thing that's important to remember is that Indigenous peoples have this kind of, there's, on one hand, there's a stigma on, I would say, all Indigenous peoples in the world, because of history of colonization, etc. But there's also an exotification, is that a word? Like, people see them as exotic, you know, because we have this idea that, they live this life bonding with nature, and they are very spiritual beings, etc. And a lot of people want to live, you know, have this experience to live with Indigenous communities. And so I think that the truth of what a lot of Indigenous communities live is in the middle, which is that Indigenous peoples are not outside of our world. They are in the same world that we are in now. And I remember people telling me, but then they don't know what internet is and they don't know that. And of course they do. They have, you know, most Indigenous peoples in the world have access to a smartphone and they have access to internet. And it's not like they live outside of this world. So that's the first thing to remember. And then being Indigenous is about identity. So there's a lot of debate around these ideas where other people from, you know, majority populations will start judging and say, but for example, to the Sami people in Norway, but now you're not using reindeers anymore to go around. You're using these electric, snow scooters. So then you're not really Indigenous anymore because you're not using the traditional ways.
Adopting technology.
Yeah, for example. Yeah. And that's not, I mean, that's not right, first of all, because it's not for the majority population to tell, you know, whoever, whatever you feel is your identity. It's not for other people to say that.
Right.
And then that's also keeping communities in this kind of secluded world where they can't have access to technology and to, I don't know, healthcare or, you know, all these things that that have been developed in the world in the past 100 years. So that's the first thing. I think that's quite important to know. And I say this because, you know, I write a lot about Norway. I've been working with Sami researchers in the north of Norway. And so I have quite a few people contacting me and asking me, oh, I want to travel to Norway. Can you help me, you know, live with the Samis, the traditional way in a lavvo and all of that? And it's like, but that then that's kind of a scene, you know, that's like playing in a play in a way.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that's an important thing to say. Also, if you're going to travel to, I don't know, Peru, you know, there are indigenous communities everywhere in the world. So Peru, the whole Amazon, there's Central Africa and a lot of countries in Africa as well. You have the whole of Asia. Mm. And the fact that in many of these countries, governments refuse to give the status of indigenous people to these people. So that means they also are not wanting to give them the rights associated. You know, for example, something I worked on a lot is having access to education in your own language. So I worked with setting up jungle schools that we called, where kids could, well, speak their own language at school and learn how to count in their own language, etc.
So
that's one, you know, access to language is very important, and then allowed to practice your own religion and not be imposed another religion by others. So there are many issues there. But what I was working with, I was working on rainforest protection, and the way we were doing that at this NGO I was working with for almost 10 years was that indigenous communities were the guardians, are the guardians. I mean, this is, you know, studies have shown this. They are the ones who can protect the forest the best because they live there and they need the forest to survive, basically. They have honey and they have, you know, fruit trees there, and they can make houses from whatever they find, leaves, etc.
Yeah.
So I've been working a lot with those communities, and the you know, the great travel experiences I have was when I was going there. I was going to the rainforest in Indonesia. So I was there in Papua. I was there in Aceh. I was in Sulawesi. In the Mentawai Islands next to Sumatra. And it's just amazing because having traveled before as, you know, a regular traveler, then you arrive there, you're the only foreigner. Most of them have actually never seen a foreigner before. And because I speak Indonesian, it's usually not their native language, but they can speak it or someone else can translate. And then you're just invited in a completely different way than if I was just traveling and then also they need me, you know, they need me because I'm kind of the link to the outside world and I'm the link to understanding the language of international media or the language of politicians. Okay. Or, you know, so there
you're,
was
you're
this,
a sort of a, your own version of a translator in some
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I think I saw myself just as a kind
an
of
in-between.
A bridge. Yeah, I'm just okay. This bridge, you know, I took what they told me and I tried to bring that message in a way that international media or campaigners in Norway would understand, so that we can influence, for example, companies in Norway to use less of the, you know, of the material or the food that comes from the rainforest.
Okay,
for
yeah,
example.
That's a specific example. So if they cut down on, I think you sent a one
palm oil,
palm oil
or,
then
yeah, tropical timber.
If they cut down on that, then that preserves the forest, and it's less. So you're kind of looking at the big picture on both sides and trying to come up with some middle place that benefits the indigenous communities
and that benefits the forest and climate as well, right?
Right.
So there's a bigger perspective there. But
it's a big responsibility to kind of...
Yeah, but I remember I was always in this duality because on one hand, I was this, you know, professional person. I was there to talk about work. But on the other hand, I was thinking, wow, this is amazing.
Just as a traveler.
As a traveler. Yeah. Once I was in Aceh and they were like, you know, there are still tigers here. And I was like, oh my God, I hope I see a tiger. And that's not even organized or anything.
Yeah.
So it's, and you have conversations with people who tell you the truth, you know, of what's happening, which is very, I mean, I feel really privileged to have heard those truths, because I think when you just travel through, they're not just going to sit down and explain all the difficulties and all the structural problems that they have as a village or as a community or with the children, you know. So it felt, yeah, it felt very privileged. But the downside is that because I didn't want to be that tourist, I took almost no pictures, because then you kind of change the dynamics with the people. And I also regret, so I have one regret, that I didn't write more while I was traveling, all these stories, you know. So I remember a lot of them.
Can you share one or two?
I can share one. Is that so I was in the Mentawai Islands, which is a small archipelago, which is not so far from Sumatra in Indonesia. And so this is an archipelago which has a lot of rainforest, because it's been like the current in the sea between the Mentawai and Sumatra is very strong. So it's been quite difficult for loggers and oil palm plantation companies to come there. So there's a lot of forest. There's a lot of people living traditionally. And you might have seen, I mean, it's very visual, because those living traditionally, they have all these tattoos, and they are called the flower people. So they have a lot of flowers in their hair, also men, and beaded
decorations.
That
sounds lovely.
And, so it's a very special place. And I was going there to check on the jungle schools. So I had all this. I had this plan of 5 schools I had to visit, and so you only get up there with a canoe. So it was kind of a long trip from Norway, plane, and then from Jakarta to Padang, and then another boat to Mentawai, and then a canoe, right? So I had several hours of canoe up there, and then we get there, and I was still, and that's an interesting thing, is that as a foreigner, you're kind of in this time frame of a Westerner, right? This day I'm going to do this, and that day I'm going to do that. And then you get there, and after about 3 hours, or maybe half an hour sometimes, you're like, this is not going to work out. Like this great schedule.
Right.
Like, this is not how it works here. And I think, yeah, that hit me every time. But that time, it had not hit me yet. So we get to the village, and there's nobody in the village. Nobody's there to welcome us. Usually you have kids and people waiting for you, right? And like, okay, this is strange. So I'm with a team and of locals, and they don't really understand either. And so we start walking in this very small village, and then we see that everybody is in the same house. They're all gathered in this house. And this lady comes up to me and says, "Do you have medicine?" And so, of course, as a traveler going to a tropical place, of course, I had medicine. And so I say, yes. And said, "Okay, our shaman is sick. Could you come and check, you know, what he has?" And I'm thinking, okay, I don't have any kind of medical training whatsoever, but sure, you're not going to say no, right? I have all this medicine. I'm not going to help him. That's not an option. So I get there, and it was such a powerful scene, because it's like they don't have electricity. So it's all these candles in this house with, I don't know, 50, 60 people. The whole village was there, around this man in with all his tattoos, almost naked. He only had his like traditional, you know, clothing. And he was very, very, very thin. And so they kind of all split to let me, you know, get closer to him. And I looked at him and I thought, this man is dying. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I could see this man was dying. And I look at his stomach, and he had this big black kind of, I don't know, stone, like a stone, you know, at the level of his stomach. And I thought, yeah, this isn't looking very good. Oh. So I thought,
like, very thin, but like sticking out like a big,
yeah, exactly. Bump. And I asked him, you know, when is the last time you ate? And he said, I haven't eaten in almost 3 months. And I figured probably he has some kind of tumor in his stomach or something like that.
Right.
So then I'm like, look, I'm really sorry. So in front of 60 people, right, the whole village, I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I can't help you. I don't have anything for this.
I mean, you just got there. How
intense. Just got there like 15 minutes earlier.
After all the traveling and everything. Okay. So intense.
And so I'm like, and all these people are looking at me like, please, please help him with, like, just give him anything you have in that little box with all your medication. I was like, oh. And I didn't want to give him anything strong. You know, you don't want to give malaria tablet to someone who's, I mean, you see,
yeah.
It's just... So I thought, okay, I'll just give him this these herbs, which are something I use when I have stomach pain, but it's not any kind of chemical. It's not a chemical. It's not pharmaceutical. It's like a bit of coal in a little pill.
Like a herbal supplement.
Yeah, it's like a herbal supplement when you have like a bit of stomach ache, basically.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I mean, this can't hurt. This is nothing, right? So... I'll just give him this and I'm off the hook in a way. And he takes this and like 5 hours later, he dies.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, I've been there
for
less than 12
hours. Did they think that you were responsible for...
Well, no, they didn't think I was responsible, although I didn't speak the Mentawai language there. So,
because that could have been a...
However,
also could have been a dangerous.
Yeah. However, so the guy died in the night. So then they like the whole village was awake and they started all these festivities. I mean, not festivities, but traditional, you know, process.
Processions
for his death. But then what happened is that the local guy who was with me told me, be very careful. I mean, the guy was sick and all that, so nobody is accusing you. However. If anything else happens here while you're here, you'll be held responsible, right?
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, a lot of these communities, at least in Indonesia, you know, they believe in spirits and witches and bad spirits coming to harm them, etc. And I was a newcomer, so all these bad things happening suddenly when I'm here is not a good thing. No.
Yeah.
And then suddenly this guy, I mean, you know, this little girl comes out of nowhere and is like, my father is sick. Can you come and help him? And I was like, oh, here we go.
Oh, my goodness. So,
and so I haven't seen a single jungle school at this point,
no
right?
Stress.
I haven't done anything about my work at all at this point. And so I go to see the guy and I have to go. And the guy was also in stomach pain, but he seemed in pretty good health condition. And he tells me he's been eating these raw, you know, shells from the river. And I guess I'm thinking, okay, maybe he has food poisoning. So I don't give him anything. And I'm like, look, just, you know, if it's not gone in 48 hours, come back.
You're running around playing doctor. I'm not here for this.
But then after all this, I'm like, okay, now we can go, right? Well, I haven't saved two people, but the guy was better. And the other one, well, they were all busy, you know, taking care of him and calling the whole forest with all this noise and all of that. And nobody could sleep because they were, you know, dancing all night. But then we start walking around and we're thinking, okay, what should we do? You know, should we leave? Because I'm on the clock. Like I have a boss back in Norway expecting, you know, results.
Norwegians are pretty on time.
Yeah. So
you
know. I was on one hand, I was thinking this is great, you know, being part of this whole funeral, being able to witness this firsthand and being with them. But then this guy comes up to us and says, oh no, you can't leave. You can't leave the village. Now that you were present while this man died, you can't leave. I think it was for 4 days or 5 days or something because the whole process was going to take that much time. And they were like, now that you were there at the beginning, you have to stay to the end. And the reason was that they believe that all the spirits of their ancestors will come and pick up the spirit of this shaman. And so if we are wandering around in the forest, they will also take us. And then we will develop mental illnesses. And because this man was a shaman, it was a very big, traditional,
very important
funeral, very important
person.
But the interesting thing is that from when he said that, I thought, okay, I'm just going to let it go. Like there's not going to be any visit to any jungle school. You know, I'm just going to go with the flow. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing because we were there together and they told me, like, you can come back anytime. And they remember me. And I became the photographer of the funeral. They asked me because I was the only one with a camera.
Wow.
And so I took a lot of pictures and then I made an album and I sent it to them afterwards. So they were really happy with that, that I could document.
Wow. And this is just one story. Just one. Incredible. Incredible.
But it's, I think it's a bit shocking to go back to the same community because change happens very fast. You know, as soon as there's a road, as soon as anything comes in, then, you know, everything changes because a lot of people from the outside world come in.
Yeah.
And also, I think what I remember the most sadly from these trips is that all these indigenous communities, at least in Indonesia, many of them have this shame of being indigenous.
Really?
Yeah, because they've been, you know, raised during the Suharto dictatorship, where it was very negative to be indigenous.
Okay, yeah. Racism.
There was a lot of racism and discrimination. So they were always saying, oh, I'm sorry, we can't offer you more than this. And I'm sorry, you know, we're not developed like you. And it's what's very ironic for me, you know, now working with environment and climate is that we're trying to cut our emissions and their lifestyle is what we're supposed to inspire ourselves from.
Yeah,
for example,
right.
You know, what does circular economy mean? Well, it means, for example, using a plate, not a plastic plate, but something that you can just throw in nature and that's going to be biodegradable. And that's what they've been doing. And keep doing. And now we're telling them, you know, to develop, you have to use all this plastic. It's a bit of a shortcut, but sometimes I feel like all of this is a bit ironic in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I could see that. I mean, yeah, it's what you're saying is we should be modeling them.
Yeah,
not them
absolutely.
Modeling us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We should be modeling them.
Yeah.
Because they have, you know, a lot of them are still building, you know, they have building knowledge for, to use only natural material, for example.
Right, right.
And then also in terms of food, they don't have intensive agriculture. In terms of water, you know, so there are a lot of things where it's actually much more sustainable. Of course, there are other issues with access to healthcare and things like that. But I think there are models there that should definitely be an inspiration for you know, the worlds that we're living in.
Mm. Yeah. Let's talk about, as it relates to your these experiences are so unique and they're not the typical experience that travelers are going to have. But we were talking about some of the topics we might want to cover today. And when you sent the email, I just wanted to read a snippet of it, if that was okay, because I think it's a great place to start on this topic. And you said, quote, "I think that traveling can impact indigenous people, but it can also help them have the visibility they need for their culture not to be eradicated. They're under a lot of pressure from their governments to assimilate and often to relocate. Their lands are filled with natural resources, which are in high demand. Tourism can be a problem if it reinforces stereotypes against them and existing power structures, but it can also, when done right, be a powerful tool because it involves money." So I guess I just wanted to hear, given your background in travel and also working directly with these communities, when you say tourism can be a powerful tool if it's done right, what do you think? And I know you don't have all the answers here, but you're coming at this from all sides. So I'd really love to hear what you think it means to do it right. And maybe there's some advice here for us as individual travelers.
Yeah. And also for those setting up these tours, right?
Yes, tour operators and those that are, you know, we have power with our purchases, our money, purchases. We have purchasing power, so we can inform the decisions companies make by choosing the right places to spend our money. So,
I think, the key here is who said yes, you know, to this tourism. In, for example, let's say, I'm going to take the example of the Mentawai that I know very well. They have this amazing traditional tattoo technique. They, you know, visually, you know, a lot of people want to take pictures of them, etc. So the question, if you want to do tourism there, which is kind of an, I don't know if it's called ecotourism, but let's call it like that in this context, I think the whole community has to accept. They have to be involved and they have to say what their boundaries are. You know, what do they want to show you? What are they going to get away from this? I remember I took some Norwegians from my work to Indonesia once, to Sulawesi, and they wanted a lot of things and from the locals. And then the locals wanted to get paid. The indigenous communities wanted to get paid and they were kind of shocked. Oh, but we're just here to see them. And I'm like, well, they have other things to do. You know, they have, they have like a house to build and they have to harvest fruit to sell it on the market. You're taking up their time. It's just like you. They have stuff to do. Then not just sitting there waiting for you to want to see them dance in their traditional clothes, right? So I think that a lot of times they're not involved and they're not consulted as a group. I know from firsthand experience that many tour operators, they go and they find one guy from a community and they tell him, look, we're going to pay you this amount and then you show us around and you'll be our guide. So then he, usually it's a man, he gets all this money and all these contacts, but the rest of the community is just left on the side of the road because they're not benefiting from this. So I think if this is a collective wish and it's negotiated, you know, they have their own decision-making processes, which can seem a bit, you know, foreign for us, but I mean, that's their way of deciding. So I think consultation is the first element that you have to keep in mind. And then of course they have to be paid. I mean, that's as simple as that. And the fact that they are paid is actually very empowering because it means that they can also stay in this area, because a lot of communities are being relocated or a lot of young people are leaving these communities because there are no jobs and because, you know, a lot of them want to have money to send their kids to school. I mean, it's as simple as that. Yeah. So a lot of people leave to be able to work, but then when they leave, they lose their land. They lose their community, their livelihood. So they usually end up in quite poor situations, very, very difficult situations in cities because there is discrimination. So yeah. I think it's empowering in the sense that then it allows them to stay in their area. Mm. But yeah, I think as foreigners, as travelers, we just have to accept that, you know, It's the same. Yeah, it's the same for them. They have a job. It might not look like my job or your job, but it's still.
Yeah. That makes so much sense. I mean, you wouldn't show up at a museum and expect to get a tour guide for free, right?
Exactly.
It's like, so that I guess comes down to, that can be difficult, of course, to suss out on the ground as an independent traveler. Well, hey, if I'm going to hire a guide or a tour operator to take me on this tour, and part of this tour is you know, I know like hill tribe trekking in Thailand's, you know, quite a popular thing. And I've done it. And this was in the late 90s. And I didn't know about any of this stuff, really, and the issues and the questions to ask. And, you know, so I think it is about asking questions. And
where does the money go? I mean, if it's just one guy getting money, is that really fair? The whole village is, you know, working towards this, or the whole village has built these traditional houses, why is it just the guy who was at that bar that you were at the same time, or the guy who speaks a little bit more English who is going to manage to get clients?
Yeah.
So it's also about redistribution inside the communities. Mm. And that's quite easy because then you can ask questions about that.
And if everybody from the community is on board, then it's a fair exchange, right? It's like, hey, we agree, we want tourists to come. You know, this is going to be the experience that we're going to sell. And then, okay, and this is going to benefit us in this way. And you're going to get to come. And I think, you know, as a traveler, to be able to come, and if it's done in this way that you're describing, where it's right, you know, it's about sharing knowledge and gaining new perspectives. And that's what travel is, I think. And these communities have so much to offer. And it's always that cultural exchange, right? And you just have to figure out how do you mediate the cultural exchange in the right way that it's fair for everybody.
Yeah. And then it's about expectations. As I said earlier, a problem I've seen is a lot of Westerners coming to these communities and being very judgmental. you know, because they use technology or because they smoke or because, and it's like, come on,
come on,
who are you really to, and it goes back to this kind of fantasy that we have of indigenous communities, that they are in this, you know, glass ball, and we are looking inside the glass ball and they are just intact.
Right.
But they are not objects. They are people living in the world like we are.
Yeah, and instead of the connection, it's like a, it's a more of an observational.
Exactly.
Kind of, yeah, that's.
And once, just a last story, once I was working for this NGO Protecting Forests, and once we get to this village and like really far, again, we had to take a canoe. I think this was in Sulawesi. For hours and hours, and we get to this place, and all these areas don't have electricity. So you hear the generator very fast, you know, that is producing electricity. And then we hear a chainsaw. And like this, for people working against illegal logging, this is like the worst thing that you can hear.
Right.
A chainsaw in the tropical rainforest,
yeah.
Right? And we hear the chainsaw and we're like, what is happening here? And then the one of the village leaders comes out of the forest with the chainsaw. And I remember those with me were so shocked. How can they cut down trees? And how can they, you know, this is against all of our policies and this and that. And I talked to the guy and he was like, well, first of all, we have to cut trees because we have to make a house. And then I talked to another lady afterwards who told me that because they wanted to show us, we were Westerners, and they wanted to show us that they were developed. So they had, you know, put on the generator, put on the chainsaw to kind of show us that, look, we're on the same level. So it's like this total misunderstanding
right,
of everything.
Right.
On one hand, that, you know, Westerners want to see this kind of intact life, total harmony with nature. And on the other hand, they want to show us that they are, you know, civilized, although this is a really bad word. And then the other thing is that we can't expect them not to cut any trees because they have a life as well. They have to build canoes. They have to build houses, you know.
Yeah.
It's, again, they're not like this object just standing there. They have to eat and they have to live somewhere, etc.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected. And I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning. And you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled BABBEL.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, you lovely listener, it's Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast. And we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value, totally free. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show.
I appreciate hearing those stories and that you sharing them, because, you know, these are important conversations to have and important perspectives to get out there. I feel that's why I really wanted to talk about a lot of this stuff and just such a unique experience you have combining all of these different sides of it. It's important stuff.
You're speechless.
I mean, I wouldn't want to become the village doctor on the fly after a long travel day. I can tell you that.
But the funny thing, when I went home to France, we had a neighbor who was a doctor, and I told him these stories, and for him it was just like the funniest story ever. But I remember when I was there, a lot of the times in these communities, I was thinking, if I were to live here, I would have to take a medical training. because that's what they need.
Right. Yeah.
They need doctors, right? They need people who can help them because they don't have access to healthcare. Mm. And unfortunately,
just geographically, it's
exactly. It's very far, and there's a lot of like things that we think is common sense, but that they actually haven't learned. So it's about germs and bacteria and you know, things like that.
Let's talk a little bit about your book here. I think this ties in with some of the things that we've been touching on a bit. So the first, a lot of this I feel is, like I said, a big theme is kind of integrating into a new culture, right? Which is a process. I suppose we could start there because this is something that applies to all travelers, right? Whether you're passing through or you're staying for an extended period of time, or a lot of people in the listening audience here, they're either on the road long-term or full-time, or they're interested in doing, you know, longer type trips, or even if you're spending just 2 or 3 weeks, you know, it always makes for better travel experiences if you can figure out some of the culture, integrate yourself a bit. You've been doing that throughout your childhood, throughout your professional life, and throughout your personal life, you know, living in another country. And you talk about a lot of the challenges of that in your book, in here in Norway specifically, which was fun for me to read because I can relate, you know, where I feel like we're like brother and sister here, like kind of through some of the same sort of experiences. Like, why are they doing that? I mean, we just ate like a piece of bread with cheese on it. Like, I never would have done that in my former life. Eat one piece of bread with cheese on it. That's called a brødskive. And with Paul egg, right? You just put something on top of one piece of bread. Like, you know, I was an American.
And
like,
drink coffee from a Moomin cup.
Yeah. I mean, I eat a big sandwich. I don't just eat a piece of bread with a little cheese on it. Yet here I am doing that. Well, we'll get into some Norwegian things, which you may have heard on the podcast before, but integrating into a culture, what do you...
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. It's like,
you want
for
some
me,
more coffee,
like,
by the way. I can pour you out some more.
Yeah,
I
mean, thanks.
Can never have too much coffee, right? we're both like extreme coffee addicts.
Exactly.
Moving here, I think Norway is one of the top five
coffee
per capita.
Consumers
yeah,
in the
per
world.
Capita.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise there with the weather, right?
Exactly. yeah, I think integrating for me is fun. It's like this code. I feel like. I want to
you want to crack the code.
Yeah, I want to crack the code, and it really is a code. Mm. And every country, every culture has this code. But what's funny with Norway is that I made this choice of going to Indonesia. All these choices I made willingly, but then going to Norway was not really a choice. I got a very interesting job here. And I didn't really want to come to Norway, but I was like, okay, I'm just going to be there a year or two, whatever. But then I'll move away.
For the job.
For the job. Yeah. And I just needed to get this first work experience that would kind of give me that CV to continue elsewhere.
So you were looking at it as more of a temporary stopover.
Exactly.
As a part of your career.
Part of my career, but also I had at the time a boyfriend in Denmark. So I also wanted to go back to Denmark. Yeah. To be with him. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, Oslo, Copenhagen can't be that bad to commute, right? Kind of the same culture. So I had that stereotype as well, not knowing at all what
just painting
in
the
Scandinavian
broad strokes.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, and so I got this job, I moved here, and it was really this in my mind, it was absolutely sure that this was temporary. And there's no surprise because everything I had done, every travel I had done until then was temporary.
Yeah.
So that wasn't going to be any different.
It just
right?
was that in your head.
Exactly. Yeah. But then I did have to learn the language because that was a requirement from my job. And also because anywhere I go, well, I want to learn, you know, what's happening and what people are saying and why they're doing this or that and what kind of food they're eating and all of this. So I started digging into all of that. And it was actually harder than expected. You know, I think it was easier for me to get to know Indonesian culture and crack that code than
really?
Norwegian. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It was tough. I mean, the language was strange to learn and the culture, there's so much hidden, I feel, in Norwegian culture. And I think it goes back probably to Protestantism, where everything is, you know, all these emotions that people don't express very clearly. I come from a culture where we laugh out loud and scream and, you know,
passionate,
argue.
Passionate
it's very
people.
Passionate, but, yeah. but this is much more contained in a way.
Reserved.
So, reserved, yeah. And then the nature was like anything I've seen before in my life. I mean, when I traveled, I talk about it in the book, but traveling to the Lofoten and to Tromsø in the winter, I mean, it's just another planet, right? It's just...
Spectacular
it's
beauty.
It's just... And you're so small. And I mean, those pictures you see online of those areas, they don't show how it's like because you're so small in this huge nature and that you cannot see on pictures. So, yeah, so that was a discovery for me. And also, I like the freedom that you have in Norway, also as a woman. There's so much more freedom here, I feel, than in many other places.
Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, just having, you know, getting this job in this NGO, this environmental NGO, I had no contacts with anyone in this NGO. I wasn't recommended by anyone. They just judged me on my CV and on interviews, of course. They trusted me. And I remember the first days at work, I was asked so much for my opinion. And I wasn't used to that, you know, being in France, working in France or in Indonesia.
Yeah.
That you ask the girl who's 25, 26, although I had a master's degree and all of that, but nobody was ever asking for my opinion, my expert opinion. Mm-hmm. And also it's about how you're treated as
respect.
A woman. Yeah, it's just respect, more respect than I had experienced before.
Wow. Yeah.
And just going home, I mean, going home... at 2 a.m. without looking over your shoulder. That was also new to me, you know, going home alone. And actually, the first blog post I wrote on my blog that became viral is called The Joys of Being a Woman in Norway. And that's kind of the blog post that made my blog go international and got a lot of readers, because that's exactly what I talk about in this blog post. And also having a child. I mean, at that time, I didn't have children, but I could see around me not just women, but men going on very long paternity leaves. I mean, my boss went on a 7-month paternity leave and he didn't answer a single email for 7 months. And he came back and he just got his job back. And it's like as if nothing had happened. Mm-hmm. In France, you leave for 3 months and it's almost as if, you know, you've been betraying your employer. I mean, that's how they make you feel.
Yeah.
So I think that freedom is something that I still value a lot in Norway. Yeah.
Reading through your book and hearing your perspective on it and what you just shared today or just now, I remember that making me feel really good about having a daughter here because, you know, hearing the woman's perspective and having a daughter and you want, of course, you want equality. You know, you want people to be respected and... For me, it reinforced that decision to be here, to raise children here instead of in the States. Again, I'm not raising them there, so I can't speak for that. And it's different, you know, it's so different everywhere. But Norway's a pretty small country and there's some homogeny, I'd say. You know, everybody has their Taco Friday across the country or whatever. But then there's all these dialects and differences in subcultures and things, which makes it interesting too. It was, for me... very good to hear that perspective from you and that your experience was so positive in that way. It made me feel really excited for my daughter's future, I guess.
And also it's funny because now I'm, you know, much more kind of grown woman. And it's funny because I hear other women the same age, I just turned 40, who live in other countries and there's always this debate. Yeah, but we can't have it all. We can't have a full-time job or a leadership job and have children. And in fact, in Norway, you can have it all. And the reason is that the society is built and work life is built for you and your partner to leave not too late, to have this, you know, flexibility, this acceptance that, yes, we have children and we have a life. And well, sometimes your child is sick. And although you have all these responsibilities, well, you're not irreplaceable for your company, but you are irreplaceable for your child. And that's kind of accepted by employers, a lot of employers here. So again, I've seen, again, men, you know, I had a colleague making a presentation for, I don't know, we were 80 people or something. In the middle of the conference, he gets a call from the kindergarten who's like, his child was sick and he just left everything in the middle of the conference. And he said, I'm sorry, my child is very sick. I need to go. And I was just like, what? And I feel so ashamed because my first thought was, why didn't they call the mother? You know, which is terrible as a woman to think that. And that just shows you how conditioned we are also as women to think, well, that's not his job. He's here doing his work. Why should he leave in the middle of this conference? But then I kind of try to deconstruct that and by talking to people, and it's like, well, these guys also accept that their wives have important jobs as well. You know, why would they be always the ones being disturbed while they're holding a conference? Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is he left and everyone was like tapping on his back like, oh, I hope she's okay. You know, I hope your daughter's okay. Have a great day and good luck. And I was like, okay. but then because everybody accepts that, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the key, is that it's accepted, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And also that men do their share work of housework, which is very important. So that we, you know, can also do other stuff. And I think that's you know, the most feminist or sexy thing I think a man can do, at least in a, you know, a heterosexual relationship, is to do the dishes and mop the floor and
you like that, huh?
and
I think, you know, my wife likes it too.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I was hanging up the clothes last night
because that's what gives also, it frees some time for us to do also other stuff, which we might find intellectually challenging, you know.
Yes. As you were kind of sharing, the social acceptance of a situation like you described where the child was sick and he could just drop everything and go. That's you're in that supportive environment. And I'm just thinking about maybe some people are listening that resonate with some of the values here that we share. You know, maybe there's some ways to, you know, if your society, I mean, I'm always trying to think a bit unconventionally, right? Like if your society does not support your values, then is there a way that you can still maintain your values within that society and set up structures or boundaries that allow you to, or maybe mindsets, right? Like in that case, it's like, well, I'm going to drop everything because my kid's sick. And I'm just going to like have the mindset where I don't care what my company thinks, you know? And that's like a way to just keep that type of value without having it offered to you in a culture or a society. That can have ramifications, of course, right? Because if you don't have the support, maybe it gets you fired, maybe. But it's just like a thought of sort of a thought experiment, right? Like in my head, like maybe there's ways around.
Yeah. And writing about, you know, other models, I work in policy changes, right? So laws can be changed. Laws on paternity leave and maternity leave can be changed.
Right. Trying to do systemic change.
Change in France.
Getting involved.
In France now, they went from a paternity leave that was 11 days, that is now a whole month. So that's three times more.
Yeah.
Is it enough? Probably not. But still, that's a huge change.
Right.
So I think, you know, fighting for those rights and for those changes and just writing about alternative models. And I think that's why also I'm talking about this now, because I just want to show that it is possible. And there are societies where it exists.
Yeah.
Right. And these are societies where we are productive and we work. But it's just that we also have a life. We can't give up everything, right? And here, I think it's just another society. I mean, there are other downsides of this society, as you probably know.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of those. Yeah,
but that
we can't. We got to take the rose-tinted glasses off at some point. Yeah. No. Well, I mean, you're right. You can get involved, and you know, the other thing is these cultures and these societies are all ever evolving, right? We tend to think of them as this static thing. But culture shifts, it changes, as you mentioned, just with the French culture adopting more maternity leave and things like that. And, you know, it's people that create those changes, individuals and collective groups. So it's exciting to think that you can be a part of a cultural change that, you know, even if it's a small part that doesn't even happen in your generation, but it took a generation of people talking about this, getting involved, starting to create cultural shifts. So it's quite fascinating when you think about it from the broad perspective of a you know, how quickly can culture change? I mean, you see it sometimes, it changes in a heartbeat, right? Like, of course, the pandemic's an example of like how that changed work culture in a big way. But you found a great way to weave in a lot of the sort of, I would say quirky, only because I'm from outside of Norway, the quirky Norwegian things. Maybe they're not all quirky, but like the Norwegian cultural things that are just a natural part of life here. But to an outsider, they just stand out so much because they're just not things we've ever done. Like the bread example I used earlier. Okay, we just made big sandwiches. We never thought to, you know, and it's just like, you know, then you start becoming Norwegian. It's so strange. Like, you know, you're here and then all of a sudden you're like, it's so funny because my wife got me a pair of those outdoor pants that have like two-toned collars.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? That like all the Norwegians wear when they're out on tour, on tour, they call it, which is like just out in the forest or, you know, out on a outdoor trip or whatever. And I was like, this is the last thing. I'm like 100% Norwegian now. Like this was the last, I have like the wool sweaters. I have the, and I have all the, like, you know, I'm a citizen now, all the things, you know, I eat the pieces of bread and blah, blah. And like, I got the outdoor pants and I'm like, now I'm officially, this is like,
so I'm
this
gonna
was the last.
I'm gonna tell you what will make you really Norwegian. Do you, when you come back from any kind of travel, also from the US, do you open the tap here in Norway, drink a glass of very cold water, and say, "Oh my God, the water in Norway is so good. I've missed it."
Well, you forgot one part. You have to let the tap run for at least 40
minutes.
Seconds.
<That's> true. <It's,
laughs> yeah, for those of you not in the know, that is a weird thing at first. I was like, why is my mother-in-law letting the water just run and run and run? It's something they do here to get the coldest water.
Exactly. And they have this idea that this water has to be amazingly cold, but also that it's a much better quality in Norway, which it probably is.
It's very good.
But it's funny that a lot of people react to that. And I've heard many Norwegians say, "Oh, I love Spain, you know, such a great holiday place. But I was so happy to drink a glass of water when I came home." Which is a very
strange
thing.
See, what I miss is
the
lack of ice. Because in America, we ice up everything.
True.
So it's like, it's always going to be cold because you have a glass full of ice.
Yeah.
But here, the refrigerator is too small to have much ice in it.
What I miss are the warm meals. You know, I'm used to I mean, I'm French, so food culture is so
important.
You
guys spend like 5 hours at lunch, right? Is that real?
Well, not five, but yeah. An hour and
so
a half.
So how do you go back to work after like drinking wine and having like a long leisurely lunch with all kinds of cheese and stuff? How do you actually go back to work after that?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have long days at work and I think we have these long pauses because the whole day is quite long. But the thing is, I love food so much, and I also write it about in the book, is that No, there's so much good food here, so much good produce, but the Norwegians just don't seem to eat a lot of it. They just eat other stuff, which has been a bit difficult for me. So I've been like trying to revive these Norwegian produce and recipes, but like cooking from scratch, and they all look at me like, "This is a waste of time. How can you spend all this time cooking?" But I just love food so much. So that's what I miss a little bit. And there's a chapter in the book where I'm invited to this traditional dinner, Norwegian dinner, and I'm already salivating like, "Oh my God, what are they going to serve? This, maybe this fish from northern Norway, or maybe, you know, the smalahove, which is the, I think it's a lamb head that is smoked in a very traditional way." And they made a taco, like a Norwegian taco.
Like box taco.
Box taco. And
yeah.
I was horrified. Totally horrified. With like minced meat in the microwave with some kind of powder.
Yeah, I mean, I at least do it on the stove, not the microwave.
Exactly, you know? But it's like, come on. So,
but
that's,
now, what do you think about box taco?
No,
still not a fan. never adopted that one, did you?
No, I never adopted that one. But I did adopt a few other things, though.
But it seems like you mentioned the boyfriend in Denmark, and then I know in the book you talk about it, so that you broke up, and then you were at this in-between time where you were in Norway, and I don't think you quite decided whether you were going to stay here and if it was going to be a long-term thing. And this, I don't know, this is another question I think that relates to a lot of travelers. This, and you can only speak, of course, from your own personal experience, but getting into a country, and then at what point do you decide to, you know, commit to like being in that cult, you know, because I think it does take a level of commitment too. You know, all right, I'm going to be here. Like, let me actually like invest in learning the in cracking this cultural code or making friends or stuff like that. Versus like being on the outside and kind of wavering, being like, oh, is this the place for me? I don't know. Maybe I should go. It's an interesting place to be as a foreigner when you come to a new country. The level of commitment that you bring to it, I think, can influence the experience, because how much are you going to, how deep are you going to dive? How much effort are you going to put in?
Absolutely. And that lasted a long time for me. That lasted maybe 5 years. For 5 years, I was like, no, I'm here temporarily.
Really?
But then
I were fighting against it a bit.
Yeah. And I didn't have any plan to
Did
go
you have
anywhere.
Any love for it at a certain point? Was it just kind of...
Love for what?
For Norway.
For Norway. Yeah, I like Norway, but I wasn't quite fitting in, I think, in a way.
It's hard.
And yeah,
it's
hard.
It's a hard place to...
And so I was always thinking, no, I might go back to Indonesia, or I might, you know, find a job in an NGO somewhere in Asia, or I might do this,
You have
I
options
might
do that. To be other places.
Yeah, I had many options. And I speak
You don't have to be
languages.
In a cold place where it's icy all winter,
no.
you know?
I mean. And I had, I speak several languages, so I had options also with different types of employers.
Right.
But then, and I remember I was living for 5 years in that flat I describe in the book, which was a flat under a big, big house, which used to be owned by a very famous Norwegian singer who went to Eurovision and all of that. And I was living in this... basement apartment for 5 years. And at some point I was thinking, okay, I have to stop kidding myself. I mean, this temporary thing is, you know, what does temporary mean? You know, 15 years is also temporary, but then, you know, buy a flat in a nicer place, which is yours, where you don't have all these people deciding for you and raising your rent, etc. So I think that at some point I thought, okay, I'm not sure I'm going to stay here forever, but the temporary element is long enough for me to invest in this place. And it's funny because for the first years I was here, a lot of people were asking me, oh, when are you going home, you know, to France? But now nobody asks me that anymore. Yeah. There's absolutely nobody asking me that, because now I'm just part of, you know, kind of the furniture or whatever. And they know I'm not leaving. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And also, I think when I started, you know, traveling, leaving to go back home to France, and it started to be like every time I was coming back to Oslo and I was getting through these gates at the airport, I was like, oh, now I'm home.
Yeah, you felt
I'm
the
so
home
happy.
Feeling.
Yeah, yeah, I'm so happy to be home. And when you have that over time, at some point you think, well, maybe this is home, you know, and I'm just going to have to accept that all this traveling era that I've been living in my whole life, maybe that's over at least for a while. Mm. And then I got children. And I mean, then that's, I wouldn't say it's over, because my own parents traveled a lot with us as children.
Right.
But I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. So what do you love about this being your home?
I think it's an easy life. It's an easy daily life. You know, there are many interesting jobs here in Norway if you speak Norwegian, at least in my field of work. It's quite an open society. So, for example, me, you know, coming out of nowhere, I don't have any family here. I don't have any connections. I still write for national newspapers, which would be almost impossible in France for a French person, let alone a foreigner. So there are many options. And work-life, I mean, there's a work-life balance that is possible.
Mm.
And also nature is amazing. Yeah. You know, so there's this kind of lifestyle that you have, which is comfortable, I'd say.
Yeah, okay.
It sounds a bit old to say that. I feel a bit old when I say that. But.
Well, I mean, with a certain level of comfort that you're describing, to me, it comes with a lot of freedom, you know?
Exactly.
Freedom, yeah. Creative freedom for me is one of my values. And a simpler life in this way, the value of nature, I think, you know, we can go out and just spend time in nature, and that can be a day. We don't have to plan, you know, 100 different activities with the kids or whatever. And just that slower pace and that mentality, to me, is a freedom in the mind of opening up with creativity and things like that. It's one of the things.
Yeah, I need free time, you know, probably like you.
It takes time to create and.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It takes a lot of time to create. And here I have the luxury of having the balance of having a full-time job, having a kid, but still having time to create, like writing books and blogs and writing articles and, you know, being part of the public debate. That's not given. In which society would I be able to do that? You know, absolutely not if I had a full-time job in Paris, that's for sure, because I would be coming home at 8 p.m. And I would be exhausted. And also the interesting thing here is that I think there are many opportunities, again, as a woman. But also there is the fact, for example, that I write on the side, I write about Norwegian culture, but I'm also, you know, working on legal, European legal frameworks. That's just fun to a Norwegian. They just think that's interesting. Whereas in France, I'm not sure they would have found that's interesting, you know, because employers just want you to do your job. They're not that interested in knowing that you have all these other skills and that you write for newspapers. Or I remember in the beginning I was writing a lot about dating in Norway, and I was petrified that my employer would find out because my blog was anonymous at the start. I was so afraid because I was afraid to lose this credibility at work.
Right.
And they would think I wasn't professional. But then when they found out, they just found it very funny and interesting. You know,
that's cool. Yeah.
So,
Yeah, that's interesting to hear because, you know, again, the perception being either reserved or uptight or something. But as you just shared, I mean, that's a...
Yeah, you're allowed to be a lot of different things, you know, which is, in my situation, that's really great for me because I feel like I'm a lot of different things. And I think more and more people want this kind of creative side of themselves to shine, and they want time to create. And then, yeah, that requires time. Obviously.
Yeah. Talk about your travels through Norway. I mean, this is a travel podcast. You did a bike trip through Lofoten.
I did several.
There was just one article in the paper, I don't know if you saw the other day, in the Aftenposten about a bike trip through Lofoten. And are you an adventure traveler in that way? Like a bike touring and stuff like that?
Yeah,
I
did that a lot. I did that in southern Norway as well. I think I'm a bit more ambitious in my mind than my body is able to follow. And I remember in the Lofoten, I was regretting a little bit because I didn't have the right gear and it was raining a lot and it was in the summer, and at some point it almost snowed a bit, and I was like, gee, why am I doing this to myself, you know?
Well, share a bit about your experience, and some people listening might want to travel to Norway. Like, give us some of your highlights and some of your tips and things like that from your experiences.
I think like everywhere else, traveling alone makes you meet a lot more people.
Yeah.
And it's funny because on one hand, one has the impression when you're in Oslo, you know, on a Monday at 9 a.m. that Norwegians are so closed and they're not talking to you and they're not very friendly. But I've been sleeping over at people's place when I was traveling on my bike alone. People were opening their homes to me, very kind, people I didn't know at all, giving me food and, you know, shelter and repairing my bike and all of that all over Norway. So I think there is this solidarity in Norway that if you need help, you can knock on someone's door and say, look, you know, I'm traveling alone. I have this problem. I mean, I think Lofoten was a very nice trip because there is so much to discover. But right now it's maybe over. I mean, there are a lot of people going there. So I would actually recommend to go to Vesterålen, which is the archipelago just north of Lofoten. I don't know if you've been there. Mm-hmm. No. And that's really amazing as well. There's just a lot less tourists than in Lofoten. Mm. And just, yeah, biking around. I remember just putting my tent. You know, in Norway, there's something called freedom to roam. You're allowed to put your tent anywhere for up to 3 days without any authorization. So it's just a wonderful life. You just put your tent next to a lake and stay there a few days and eat some bread with pole.
You know, I might go camping tonight, actually, or tomorrow, because we can just walk right over here into the forest. Yeah, I think we're due for a camping trip, and that's a nice...
I think that I would like to camp more now that my kid is a bit bigger, but he loves camping. the first, he's 3 years old. The first thing he does when we go camping, he takes off all of his clothes. It's like, this is the life. Throws himself in the river or in the lake. Yeah. And there's a type of freedom to be in nature, I think. And actually, during the pandemic, there was a lot of focus on friluftsliv, mm-hmm. this Norwegian concept of enjoying being outdoors, just without any goal in particular. And I wrote a piece about that, and it was picked up by CNN.
Really?
Because they were looking, you know, CNN Health, because they were looking into this concept on how can we help, for example, American people to have a more balanced life during the pandemic and not just being, you know, at home working all day and all night, but actually be able to go outside and enjoy nature also close by, not necessarily mm-hmm. take a plane. And
yeah.
But there is something there in Norway where, you know, it's totally normal for people to just say, you know, what are you doing this weekend? It's like, oh, I'm camping with my two kids for the whole weekend. And that's like a total normal thing to say here, even mm-hmm. in the middle of the winter, mm-hmm, which I find quite... It's like, yeah, we're going snow camping with my five-year-old and my three-year-old. Okay. And trekking. Okay.
Yeah. But you found this place to be, for somebody that hasn't gone on like a bike tour or some adventure like that before, it's still pretty... You can still do it and you can...
Yeah, you can. Yeah. It's a bit tough.
Did you own a bike or did you rent one?
No, I bought one actually.
Okay. And this is something I want to do. That's why.
Yeah, and this was before electric bikes were affordable. So I just had a normal bike, but I had very few things. I was transporting very few things.
Yeah, right.
So I was traveling light. Mm. But I think there's a lot of ups and downs. And I think one of the mistakes many people do when coming to cycle in Norway is that they don't realize how long the winter lasts here. So you shouldn't think that there's, you know, it's okay to bike in the north of Norway in April without specific tires, because there's still snow up there in April.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of some of the roads are closed, there are snowstorms. So you have to be equipped like properly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in the summer, I mean, there's a lot of, it goes up and down. The whole West Coast is pretty rough. I haven't tried that yet, but I've tried the South Coast is much more flat. So I'd definitely recommend that. I did Porsgrunn to Kristiansand cycling on my own, and that's quite flat and it's a beautiful coast.
Okay.
Really amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll let you go in a minute. I wanted to ask you about how much did writing help you process your journey of integrating into a new country?
Yeah, it definitely helps. And I think that's why I started writing this blog. It was kind of, you know, anger management / trying to vent, you know, with humor, whatever was happening to me. And because it's rough to integrate in a new culture without understanding anything. And what's funny, in every single culture I've tried to integrate in, is that the persons you talk to, for them, everything they do is normal. That's the norm. And and like, as an outsider, you're like, yeah, it's your norm, but it's not everybody else's norm. Yeah. And I have to learn that norm because that's not natural to me. And so yeah, writing has been a great tool. And I think this book, you know, A Frog in the Fjord, it was my way. It was kind of a gift for other travelers or foreigners, for them to get those codes given to them, because I would have loved to read this book before coming to Norway. If this had been available, it would have really helped me, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's great even for people just traveling through to get a better sense of some of the things. So when you see things happening, you understand and you have some context.
Yeah.
What is the strangest Norwegian thing, do you think?
There are so many. I think the way they deal with conflict, I think that's still very strange to me. There's this kind of avoid, they avoid conflict a lot. And I thought for many years that there weren't any conflicts in Norway. And then I realized they're there, but they're just not very visible. and they're dealt with in a completely different way. So I think that's still something that's a bit mysterious to me somewhere sometimes. You don't see people, you know, arguing and screaming, but still people, you know, resign from their jobs and divorce. And so there are conflicts there, but right. It's just to the naked eye, it's very hard to see sometimes what people and just what people feel in general. And I remember a Norwegian guy said, you know, we never get angry in public or even, yeah, with anyone. And that's why we go skiing so much, because that's how we get it all out. And that's why we go in nature. And yeah, maybe not just conflict, but yeah, the way people show emotions and, you know, everything is always so measured and the tone is even. But then when you try to understand what's behind that, you realize that there are difficulties and people having mental health issues. And it's just not as open. People don't talk about it as much as in other cultures. Yeah.
Because I'm not from Norway, I feel like if I want to express myself in a certain way, I can get a free cultural pass because, you know, well, he's not Norwegian. And it might cause people to open up a bit more because they feel comfortable because they know I'm from outside. So I can have this type of reaction or this type of conversation, or I can, you know, this guy's talking to me on the street, but it's not weird because he's not Norwegian. Oh, I like this. This is kind of nice, you know, because they're famously known for not talking to each other on the street, exactly. Which is totally bizarre for me. and sometimes I miss that about America. So I might just, you know, kind of have the random comment to the person in line or whatever.
In Northern Norway.
And when they realize I'm not Norwegian, they're just okay with it. And they also in some ways maybe seem to welcome it because it's a change from the regular. You know, maybe that's just in my head. Maybe they're just like, this guy, just stop talking to me right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And there are areas in Norway where you can talk to people in the street. For example, in Northern Norway, it's completely normal, I think. But yeah, there is this free pass. And I used it a lot in the past, but I don't know if I became too Norwegian and I don't use it that much. But also, I see a shift actually right now that I've been this, you know, funny, or I feel like I've been seen like this funny French girl observing Norway, and I had a free pass on a lot of stuff. But now more and more, I've been here now for 14 years, and I think also my Norwegian has gotten much better.
Right.
And I feel now that they just expect the same from me than from all the other Norwegians. And that's a bit hard sometimes because, yeah, I've integrated well, my Norwegian is good, but it's still not my culture. And I don't have all the references and... Yeah. You know, so it's, yeah, there's always a journey to integrate more. It's never over. It's like a life project. You know,
yeah.
In a way.
I guess that's one of the things that keeps it really interesting too, right? I still learn new things about the culture and then through that about myself, you know. What a treat. What a great time. I had so much fun chatting with you. I can't thank you enough for coming up here to have the conversation, or down or left or right. I don't know which way you came, but your book is A Frog in the Fjord. And of course, we'll link to all this and the same for the website name. But do you want to share anything else here? Just go ahead and let people know where they can get in touch.
The book is available on Amazon. It's been recommended by Forbes. So I'm really happy. It's a bestseller in Norway as well. So it's working really well. And I'm really hoping that even people who are not, you know, living in Norway or traveling necessarily to Norway could read this, because we've all read books about travels elsewhere without necessarily going there, because it's kind of a journey somewhere else. And yeah,
it's a really fun travelogue in a way to look at Norway, but it's through your stories and your experiences, you share a lot of aspects of the Norwegian culture. I'm like, I think she pretty much covered everything, but like doing it through your own personal story, which made it super engaging. I really enjoyed it. I want to say congratulations on all your success. I'm really glad we're in touch and look forward to hanging out. We could get the families together sometime, you know? Let's high five it out. Thanks again. And we'll be chatting soon.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
There you have it. A quick thanks once again to Laura Lou Desjardins. I won't speak any more French, I promise, the rest of the show. I want to thank her for stopping by my house and letting me record this great conversation with her.
and allowing me to share it with you, which is always a privilege. What an incredible community we have here. Don't forget, you're not alone listening to this podcast, and I do invite you to get in touch anytime. My email is jason@zerototravel.com. You can leave a voicemail with that link in the show notes. Very easy to do. Looking for any guest recommendations, feedback on the show. You can share your story, travel tips, anything, really. Just get in touch and say hello. Would love to hear from you. And I do want to thank David for getting in touch. He's a listener, and I want to give him a shout out here. He reminded me of a phrase I haven't said in a while that I love. Anyway, I'll read the email first. He said, "Dear Jason, just wanted to reach out, tell you how much I love the podcast. I travel on the road every day as a home health physical therapist in South Louisiana. Listening to your shows as I drive has helped me with my future travel dreams. While my family and I do get to go on some pretty amazing fast travel vacations every summer, including Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Hawaii, and numerous national parks in the USA, my wife and I dream of the day when we can do some real, quote, slow travel, both domestically and internationally." And he goes on to share some more kind words about the show. And I just wanted to say thanks for writing and for reminding me of a phrase I usually belt out with a guitar in hand while I'm strumming some chords. You got to keep the dream alive. Keep the dream alive. Got to keep the dream alive. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it fires me up because sometimes the dreams can get dulled. Dulled under the struggles of life or, you know, everyday routines, whatever. And it's good to remind ourselves of our big dreams and to keep them alive every single day. Don't let them die out. You know, it's okay if they wither sometimes. Sometimes you have a plant and it needs watering. You forget to water it for a couple weeks, but then you water it and it sort of springs back to life and gets its greenery back and the flowers perk up. That plant is your dreams. So keep the dream alive. Water your dreams today is what I'm saying. I didn't know I was going to say that, but that's what I'm saying now. Be sure to water your plants and your dreams today. Okay, I'll leave you with this quote, a good reminder where you can find inner peace any moment of the day. This one's from Buddha. "Do not look for a sanctuary in anyone except yourself." I'll leave you with that. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. Peace and love to you and yours. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.